Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic.
Yes.
What a great place for a meeting. Yeah. This is really cool. We came down yesterday. We wanted to soak in some of Philadelphia. It's one of our favorite towns. And we've had a really, really good time. And this is a great way to top it off, an AA meeting. Like I said, I'm an alcoholic. I'm one of those, when I'm drinking, I'm one of those pathetic type of alcoholics, you know, like you don't want me in your house, you know, like vomit on your rug or like park in your shrubberies or, you know, say really inappropriate things to your wife or whatever. It's just, you know, and you know, if you see me the next day, you know, you're just going to say, just don't bother coming around anymore. And, you know, I always didn't get it, you know, like, what's their problem? You know, because when you're really drunk, you don't realize how insane you are. I'll tell you one story. This is my last DWI. I had a bunch of them, but I'll tell you the story about my last DWI. Supposedly, I crossed the double yellow. You know how that is. I disputed that, but supposedly I crossed the double yellow. Now the cop came up to the car, and I rolled down my window, and he goes, license, registration, insurance card. And I reach into the glove compartment, and there's like a lot of stuff in there, hard to deal with, you know, and I'm like, shuffling it around and trying to figure it out. Like 5 minutes later, I just give up and I hand them the entire contents of the glove compartment, you know? Maps and hairbrushes and, you know, scissors and all this stuff. And he wasn't real happy about that. So he does a quick sobriety test and he handcuffs me and takes me up to the police station. Now, does anybody remember hazy recollections? You know, like the next day you kind of remember a little bit of something. Well, I remember that I nailed the ABCs in the sobriety test. Okay? I nailed them. You know, it had nothing to do with me learning them when I was three, but I nailed them. And I ended up, you know, refusing the breathalyzer. And what happened was, the next day I was very indignant about this whole thing. Okay? This, I don't believe that they did this to me. So I hired this lawyer. It's like a $1,500 lawyer, and we, you know, we're going to fight this thing. So the first thing we do is we go up to the police station to view the video. Has anybody in here ever seen their DUI video? You need, like, therapy after that. It's so disturbing. Anyway, I thought I did really well. And so I'm there with this lawyer in the three-piece suit. He's like really serious, you know, $1,500 worth. And as the cop hands him the VHS tape, the cop sniggers, you know, like this. And I saw that as a bad sign, and it was because he put it into the VCR, and the picture came up, and I was horrified. I was tongue-chewing, knee-walking drunk, you know. And it got to the ABCs, and I nailed the ABCs, right? Here's how I nailed them. A, B. And I'm like, I'm embarrassed, I'm horrified, I'm sitting there, and, you know, the lawyer's like this. And there's sections of the tape where, you know, they're saying, no, take your hands off the wall while you're walking the line. Because I'm like walking the line like this. I would bury my head in shame. Now it comes to the end of the tape, and the cop goes, you know, do you have anything to say before we turn off the camera? And I'm like worried, you know. And I turn to the camera and I go, aah! Like this, right? Now the lawyer who had been, you know, he'd been prim and proper, he bursts out in hysterics. He's going, aah! I've never seen anything like it for 30 years. I never seen anything like it. You know, if you had any chance of beating this, you know, no way, you know. And I'm like, okay, I guess we'll plea, you know. And now, I had no idea I was that pathetic. I actually hired a lawyer to defend me, you know. And, you know, this is kind of the story of my life. Now, My alcoholism, I believe alcoholism is a spiritual illness. I think that drinking is in reaction. The way we develop our relationship with alcohol is in reaction to a very, very deep spiritual problem. And I'll start when I first recognized that spiritual problem. I had turned 5 years old, and my mother said to me, get ready, I'm taking you to kindergarten today. You're starting kindergarten. And I'm like, kindergarten? And she goes, get in the car, you know, packs me all up, drives me across town, opens up the door and says, there's the kindergarten, I'll come get you in about 4 hours. And the car door slams, and I'm standing up on the hill looking down at this kindergarten class, okay, the building, and there's kids outside, they're running around, they're playing tag and kickball. It looked like they were all friends already for life. Now I'm standing up on the hill looking down like thinking, whose idea was this? This is not good. You know, this could go really wrong. And I started to become overwhelmed with like a self-centered fear, an anxiety. I thought, you know, what if they don't like me? Or, you know, what if I do something stupid, you know? I mean, I was just inundated with this self-centered fear. But I knew I had to go do it. So I just like sucked it up and went down there and did the kindergarten thing. But I wasn't happy about it, you know? I was very uncomfortable with myself, and I was very uncomfortable with my environment from a very, very early age. Now, you know what would have fixed that social anxiety? A pint of whiskey. You know, I'm telling you. That would have hooked me up. But the thing was, they weren't serving 5-year-olds back then. But I'm telling you, I would have done great. I'd have been the kindergarten kid with the whiskey, you know? So, from kindergarten until about 8th grade, I had to act as if everything was okay inside me. It wasn't okay. I was always worried about what you were thinking about me. You know, like, he's looking at me. He's thinking bad things. I mean, I was just completely crippled with this spiritual malady. And this one day, I'm with a couple of my buddies, and we decide to cut school and go back to my house and get drunk. You know, we'd heard about this thing, getting drunk. So we did this, and we went back to my house, and I brought down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey, you know, that was way in the back shelf, dusted it off, and poured 3 big water glasses of Four Roses whiskey. Now, I want to mention a little something about what happened to the 2 guys I was with. The 2 guys I was drinking with never became alcoholic. They never became problem drinkers, to my knowledge. What they did was they drank about 2/3 of the glass, and they'd had enough. You ever drink with people like that? They have enough on you? You know what I mean? Wait, you had enough? You're going home? Are you nuts? Let's go to the city! You know, it's only 1 in the morning. You know, what's the matter with you? You lightweight. Well, these guys had 2/3 of the glass, and they'd had enough. And they sat back and they watched the show. Because here's what happened with me. I drank my whole glass, the rest of their glasses, the rest of the bottle, and I experienced my first blackout. Any blackout drinkers in here? Is that disconcerting? You know, whole sections of time that are missing? You know, what did I do last night? You know, hey, you ever have to go look for a car with like an earth person? You know, hey, could you help me find my car? Well, where'd you put it? I don't remember. You know, you look like an idiot. But anyway, I went into a blackout. I trashed the house, and I woke up in a field just as sick as you could be. Remember, the first drunk sick, you know. You have to remain horizontal for like 2 days. Now, I mean, I was illing off of this. And I missed like 3 days of school. It was awful. Now, if there was any other food or beverage that would have made me that ill, I would have avoided it like the plague, you know? Like a fish allergy or, you know, rutabagas make you sick. You know, I'd have stayed away from it. I wouldn't have needed a 12-step rutabaga program. You know what I mean? Wouldn't have had to call my sponsor and, you know, or anything like that. I'd have just been able to not have any more. Here's what happened to me, though, when I started drinking that Four Roses whiskey. You know that scared kindergartner that was like inside me with that anxiety? You know, I mean, that person disappeared. All of that fear left me. All that anxiety left me. And I felt larger than life. All of a sudden, I felt this new freedom and new happiness that the alcohol provided to me. It was the antidote to my spiritual malady. That's exactly how it worked. And then I learned how to projectile vomit. You know, I went overboard a little bit. But I'm telling you, there were dancing lessons in that Four Roses whiskey. You know what I mean? It offered me the solution that I was looking for to life. So I started to become very, very preoccupied with alcohol. I need to use alcohol. Alcohol is going to be a tool for me. I'm going to develop a relationship with this stuff. I'm not going to drink Four Roses anymore. You know, I'm going to, you know, beer, whatever I'm going to go to. But I'm going to need this stuff to be able to relax, to be able to calm down. You know, it's really, really strange the relationship we have to alcohol. Toward the end of my drinking, it was really, really apparent that I was not okay without alcohol. You know, I remember times where I would go up to the bartender, and I didn't say this, but I might as well have. Bartender, quick, I'm sober. You know, hurry up, get over here, quick, and back me up. You know, I want 3 double whiskeys, you know, in case you take too long getting back here. I got a real problem here. I'm sober, you know. I mean, that's the way I would feel. And then I'd start drinking this stuff, and I'd go like, And then I'd crash a car or do something crazy, you know? And it was always a problem. It was always a problem. You know, I started drinking in the very late 60s, really motored into drinking in the 70s. There was a lot of other substances that were around, you know, in those eras. And I'd partake of them, let me tell you. You know, if it would get me out of me, I'd partake of them. I'd just snatch it out of your hand and eat it and then say, by the way, what was that? You know? I remember the great Quaalude epidemic of 72, okay? Anybody remember the Quaaludes? Oh, my God. They were really hard on the furniture, weren't they? You know? But anyway, this guy brings in this big sack of Quaaludes to school this one morning. He'd been given them by his brother the night before to sell. And he's selling them for like $1 a piece. And we're like, well, how many do you take? And he goes, it's 3 or 4. Oh, my God. The ambulance was back and forth all day long. There was like about 100 of us that took like 3 or 4 Quaaludes in first period. Oh, man. I remember I was walking down the hall, hanging onto the lockers like this. And finally, I gotta get out of here. I made a break for it, and I busted out the door, there's a 300 wing, heading for the woods, forgetting that the whole 300 wing is watching me. And they told me the next day, oh, Chris, that was great, man. You were heading for the woods. It took you like 10 minutes to go 100 yards. You know? I thought I was moving. And I, you know, I'd get in trouble with it. I'd get in trouble with all this stuff, you know. There was even the bizarre drugs. You know, I'd eat them just because they were drugs, like LSD. I never really liked LSD, but I'd take it, you know. And I remember this one time we took way too much at a concert in New York City, and we all piled in this van heading back into Jersey. And you know where the Lincoln Tunnel goes? There's like 8 lanes, and they go down to 2 like this. Well, somebody sitting in the front, you know, makes a comment. He goes, hey, man, we'll never fit. Right? And so we all, like, move to the front of the van, and we're, like, looking at him. He's like, he's right. it's a mouse hole, you know. And so it took us 45 minutes to back out, you know, and go to the bridge. It was, you know, we're always having problems like this. You know, and you know, the funny thing was is you don't recognize what the heck is happening to you. One of the really, really dangerous things about addictive illness is that it doesn't allow you the dignity to be able to perceive just how much trouble you're in. You know, if you're an alcoholic or you're suffering from chemical dependency, chances are you don't have a clue how much trouble you're in. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we cross a line. And most of us cross this line before we even really want to stop. We cross the line to the point where we can't stop drinking on our own unaided will. You know, we've placed ourselves into powerlessness, you know, where no matter how hard we try, we can't rebuild our lives. We can't fix the things that are going on. We can't stay away from these substances. And, you know, I went on for years and years and years. I drank for about 20 years. You know, my first year of drinking, I had a DWI and 5 car totals. You know, I'm not a stupid guy. Wouldn't you think that you could figure out that maybe you shouldn't drink and drive? You know, but I come from a period of time where friends let friends drive drunk. You know, that was really what was going on in those days. You'd walk to the party, get really drunk, go home and get the keys. I mean, it was nuts in those days. But anyway, here I'm moving along. I come from a very, very smart family. I have a brother and a sister who are both college PhD professors. And, you know, my mother and father were both Phi Beta Kappa, just educators, just really, really overburdened with intelligence, this family. And when I started drinking, okay, I went from, you know, maybe an average student down to like the stupidest kid in the class. I mean, I wouldn't do tests. I'd get my locker at the first day of school, stuff all my books in it, close it, and then forget for the rest of the year where it was. You know, to get out to leave school, I have to like find my locker and turn the books back in. But it was really, really bad, and you know, the whole quality of my life started to go downhill. And it wasn't like I recognized it. It's not like you say to yourself, you know, this alcohol is becoming a preoccupation, and if I keep on like this, you know, my grades will suffer and I may not get into the college of my choice. You don't think like that. You think like, just get off my back. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Just leave me alone. It's none of your business. And that's really the way my attitude started to change. I graduated second stupidest kid in from high school. You know, the guy who beat me out couldn't read or write, and I'm hanging out. I'm just like hanging out, like partying full time, and I'm recognizing something that my friends are disappearing. Some of them are going off to college. Some of them are getting jobs. There's a few of them that are getting married. You know, they're moving on with their life. And more the people I go out and party with are disappearing. And I'm replacing them with lower and lower common denominators. Toward the end of my drinking, the people that I partied with didn't even have names. You know, they were like Weezer and, you know, Green Man. You know? I mean, really, Rat was one of them with 2 T's. You know, he made that distinction. So these are my buddies. But somewhere along the line, you know, I realized, you know, I should do something. I should go to college or something. And a friend of mine was up from school back, and I met him in a bar. And he says, man, you should come down to my college. There's a bar in every building on campus, and all the drugs that come into the United States come through our town. You know, so I'm signing the application the next day. Could have been a stewardess college for all I had no idea. You know, so down I go to the University of South Florida. And that was a really, really dark period in my life. I'd hooked up with this woman and you know, kind of took her hostage, and I took her hostage because she made the mistake of liking me, you know, and she also thought about me as much as I did, so there was chemistry. And she comes up, and we start this family, you know. I get married. I propose in a blackout, supposedly. And I come out of a blackout the next day, and the invitations are going to printer, you know. And instead of making a big scene, I figured, it's 6 months away. But I ended up getting married, starting a family, and I'm telling you, I could not provide the emotional support, the financial support, the emotional security. It was inconvenient for me to do that. You know, she wanted me to get insurance on the car and to come home at night and, you know, stop hanging out with Green Man and Weezer. You know, I mean, you know, like all this stuff, you know, get a job she wanted me to do. You know, I was like, it was tough. And I couldn't do it. You know, I was in the middle, I was being catapulted, you know, through alcoholism, and it just didn't seem to me to be a priority to, like, grow up. And so she ended up leaving, and I moved in with a couple of guys who, they were real partiers too, and we ended up in this house, and it was some of the darkest days of my drinking, some of the most decadent. You know, we can really go down the scale pretty far. I ended up crashing more cars, and the cops were after me, and, you know, I hadn't done community service, and, you know, all, you know, tickets and bill collectors, and, you know, it started to build up on me, and, you know, I thought, you know, I wonder if Mom needs any help around the house back up in New Jersey, you know, and because that's what you do when you're like a macho guy, you know, and all your scorecards read zero. You see if Mom needs some help. And I moved back up to New Jersey, kind of in defeat, but still drinking really, really heavily. Ended up catching her house on fire twice, and, you know, that was an ugly piece of time. I only moved back in with her for 6 years, you know, my worst drinking. But increasingly I became more and more violent, you know. I think what happens with us is, you know, we're good people that are doing bad things, and we're smart people that are doing stupid things, and we have a conscience. As an alcoholic, I believe that, you know, we have a conscience. When we do these things, we have to bury these things somehow, like with more alcohol, because, you know, we really don't want to do some of the things that we do. And it just, you know, my life got more and more grim, and I started to just react more and more violently. And this went on and on and on. And I'll skip to my last drunk. It started at my mother's house. My brother and sister had come home for Christmas. There was some nieces and nephews, you know, family animals. I mean, you know, the Christmas tree was up, and there was presents, and the carols were on, and, you know, the stockings were hung by the chimney with care. And, you know, it was just this beautiful little vision, and I start drinking Johnny Walker Black. Okay, that's my Christmas drink, you know. And I allowed myself to be overserved, and I go into this violent, violent blackout tantrum where I actually threaten all their lives. I'm going to kill all of you, you know, and kill you. And that's not really the festive atmosphere they're really looking for. So what they did was they took their Christmas elsewhere. You know, they told me later they didn't want to sit there and watch me die, you know. So they took off and they went upstate New York to my sister's house and had Christmas. And I come out of this, like, it's like a 4 or 5 day blackout. I come out of this blackout. And, you know, I'm shattered. I'm in the DTs, you know, I'm hallucinating. There's, like, animals scratching on the house to get in, and there's, like, maggots and, you know, marching bands. I mean, anybody that's ever had the DTs, you're freaked out. And I'm going through this, and I go in the kitchen, and there's a pile of vodka bottles like this in the sink, and you know, I don't even remember buying them, and you know, I start to really get scared. My blood pressure's really up, so I track him down with the phone, and I remember I begged him to come home. Like, will you please come home? I'm really in trouble here. And they said no. no, we don't, we're not strong enough to watch this. You're going to have to do it on your own. And for 2 or 3 days, I struggled through this detox. You know, most people would call the ambulance or something because you die from these type of detoxes. I wouldn't do that because the people in the ambulance would come and the first thing they'd do is look at me and think I'm lame. You know what I mean? And I couldn't bear that. So I'll die. I just don't want to look bad. You know, typical alcoholic. So I struggled through this. And, you know, I'd been exposed to AA. I'd been in a treatment center prior to this. I'd been to some outpatient, you know, very tentatively because, I don't know about that stuff. And it got to a point where I could get to a meeting. And I remember, you know, looking through the meeting book. And at this point in time, I had a Ford Granada, 1976, with white walls, with no clutch, no emergency brake, no heater, no muffler, you know, orange paint spread about the interior inexplicably. And it was just it was a piece of crap, $100 car. And, you know, so I'm looking through the meeting. I've got to find a flat meeting because there's no clutch in the car. I can't maneuver any hills. So I'm looking through the book and I find a flat meeting. And off I go to this flat meeting. And I remember there was a tiny little hill to get up into the parking lot. And as I'm pulling in and going up this little incline, I've got to gun this thing because there's very little clutch left. And remember, there's no muffler. So everybody is standing there having cigarettes on the porch, and I drive by them about a mile and a half an hour going like, whoa! Like this. And they're all looking like, must be a new guy, you know? I parked it against a tree because there was no emergency brake, and I walk into the meeting. Now, I'm shattered, okay? And I go in and I sit down, and, you know, I'm like this, and somebody goes, Here's a step book. And they hand me a step book. And I'm looking like this, right? And they go, we're reading from step 12. And I look down the row, and sure enough, they're reading from step 12, and they're coming at me. It's going to be about 2 more paragraphs, and I'm going to have to read. You know, I can't do it, okay? This is too much. Right? So I'm like, oh, my God. You know, So I get up and I leave, okay? And I'm standing out on the porch saying, oh my God, this is too much. I can't believe, you know, I've got to read, you know. And this guy saw me leave. Swear to God, you know, we're here by seconds and inches sometimes. This guy saw me leave and went out onto the stoop there where I was having a cigarette and comes up and he goes, you know, hi, my name's Jorge. Hi. You know, what's your deal? And I said, so there's relaxers, demons, aurals, they're vomiting, everything. I was just freaking out. And he goes, well, why don't you come on back into the meeting? And come on back into the meeting. And I'm like, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night. Tomorrow night there's a meeting. And he was smart enough to know what tomorrow means for an alcoholic. You know what I mean? So he wouldn't let me go. He wouldn't stop. So finally I go, oh, all right, I'll go in. The only seats left are up in the second row, and he sits me down in the second row. By now, they're done reading the paragraphs, and somebody's sharing. You know, they're sharing on something or other. I have no idea. Nothing makes sense to me. You know, I'm so self-conscious that I can't even hear the words out of anybody else's mouth. And he leans over to me, and he goes, okay, now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. I'm like, what? He goes, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. And I go, oh, there's a meeting tomorrow. And tomorrow everybody raises their hand. Everybody's coming back. And, you know, again, he knows what tomorrow means, right? So he goes, he's starting to get loud now. You know, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. And now people are starting to look at me. Okay? That's just too much to bear because as soon as they start looking at you, they're going to be thinking at you next, you know? And I can hear people thinking at me. You know, when I'm detoxing, I can hear people thinking at me. So this is getting freaky, so I figured the only way to shut this guy up is to raise my hand. Now, I've never seen this done before, never seen it done after. Right in the middle of somebody sharing, I raise my hand, you know? And the leader of the meeting, like, looks and is a little, you know, curious and shuts the person up who's talking and calls on me. And, you know, I said something very profound like this.
Thank you.
And it's dead quiet for about 10 seconds. And then all of a sudden, yay! Everybody starts cheering, okay? Now, I took it as acceptance, you know. I now know everybody is like, oh my God, you pathetic son of a bitch, you know, I thought I had problems. Thank you! Oh. You know, I now know that, you know, that's really what it was. But I took it as acceptance. And here's the thing, that wall of fear that was in between me and actually being able to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get busy about the work of recovery, that wall of fear, a little bit of it got knocked down, you know, by me being able to raise my hand. And the next day I got a sponsor and a home group, and I started to do the things that you know, you're asked to do. See, alcoholism is a really unorthodox illness. The obsession of the mind. No matter what you do, you can't keep from putting a drink in your body. That's what the obsession of the mind is. The allergy of the body. Once you start drinking, you have little power over the amount you take, you know, and you close the bar. And then the unmanageability. You're restless, irritable, discontented. You've got self-centered fear, depression, anxiety, guilt, remorse, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's all the unmanageability. Now, that's unorthodox as an illness. And it's very, very difficult to understand. But even more difficult to understand is the recovery process. I start going to AA meetings like you wouldn't believe. I'm going to like 14 meetings a week. I don't know what else to do. I've run out of plans, and I'm desperate. I never want to go through another detox like that again. You know, and threatening to kill my family got my attention. You know, that's not really something I want to come out of a blackout and find out I did. You know, so I'm just throwing everything I can into the fellowship. And I remember I'm working as an electrician at this point in time. And this guy comes up to me, because I'm telling everybody I'm an AA, you know. I'm an AA. And, yeah, I go to those meetings. And this one guy comes up and goes, well, what happens at those meetings? How do those meetings keep you sober? You know, tell me about a meeting. And I go, well, you know, you walk downstairs into the church basement, you know, you get yourself a cup of coffee, and then you sit down, and they say the Serenity Prayer, and, you know, then it'll be like a topic, like somebody will have a resentment, and somebody will share a resentment, and then somebody will say, I had a resentment too, and they'll all share about their resentments, and a basket will get passed, and at the end, we all stand in a circle and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. Now, he's backing away from me at this point in time, right? And I start to think, he's right. How the hell does that work? You know what I mean? How is that? How does that keep me from drinking? The recovery process is very, very hard to understand. And some of us need to do these things, not because we think they'll work, but because other people are telling us that it'll work. You know, and that's really what happened with me. My sponsor was, here's what you're going to do, Chris. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. And I'm about a year and a half sober, going to a lot of meetings. I mean, here's how, I was still like emotionally a wreck. And I would get up in the morning and I'd go to work and I'd come home from work and I'd go to sleep. I'd have to take a nap. And I'd wake up and I'd go to a meeting. Then I'd go out to the diner and then I'd go back home and go to sleep. I mean, I had a complete lack of dealage. I mean, I couldn't do anything except work and go to a meeting. For a long, long period of time, I really had a lot of healing to do. And what was happening with me is I was sober, okay? I was sober, but I hadn't engaged in a recovery process. What I was doing was I was going to a lot of meetings, I was making coffee, I was a secretary here, treasurer there, you know, I mean, I was busy, I was going out to the diner, but I hadn't engaged in any of the recovery work. So I was still really, really repressed. I still had that spiritual malady. That scared kindergartner was still all over me. And I was just acting as if I was okay. Like if you would have come up to me at a meeting and say, hey, Chris, how you doing today? Fine. Okay, fine. I mean, that's what I'd say, right?
I couldn't tell you, well, I've got, you know, all this repressed anxiety, you know, the feelings of, you know, I want to kill people, you know, and I want to kill you. And
yeah, I mean, you can't be honest like that. So I'd say, fine. Now, what happened was, there was a guy that I used to hang out with. His name was Radio Shack Mike. And Radio Shack Mike went to the self-help bookstores and stuff, and he listened to tapes. He'd given me a set of tapes this one time. They were affirmation tapes, okay? And he asked me to try it. Now, this didn't work real well with me. It was, you put these tapes on, and then you stand in front of the mirror, and you say 100 times, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. You're trying to affirm you're a wonderful guy, right? Well, I'm like, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Bullshit! Yeah, I'm an idiot! You know, I my self-esteem was in the toilet. It just didn't work for me. So he gave me another set of tapes this time. And these were big book workshop tapes. There was 8 90-minute tapes. I'm like, holy mackerel. You know, are you kidding me? That's, you know, that's like 12 hours. You know, he goes, well, you're hardcore. You'll like them. You know, and he hands these to me. And they were an early Joe and Charlie workshop. Now, I had a long ride to work. So, I mean, the affirmation tapes didn't work on me. And, you know, I now understand that trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb, you know. But these other tapes were different. I started to listen to them. And the first thing that happened to me was I started to get upset. They were basically saying, Chris, you don't have a program. You're involved in the fellowship. You're going to a lot of meetings. You know, you're making a lot of coffee. That's the fellowship. The program of recovery is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless you're actually taking those spiritual exercises from the book, you don't have an AA program, because that's what an AA program was. Now, I did not like this information, okay? Immediately, I hated everybody from Arkansas, you know? And but I got to tell you something. I listened to them. I threw them on the shelf. It was something. But sometimes the truth, you know, the first stage of truth is sometimes you get really mad at the person who's telling you the truth. But the truth will haunt you, and sometimes you have to come to terms with that truth. And I had to come to terms with some of the things they were saying in these tapes, because they did make a lot of sense. I wasn't happy to hear this stuff, but it did make a lot of sense. So what happened was, in my area, there really wasn't anybody that would say, hey, come on over to my house, we'll go through the big book, I'll help you with the steps. That's not how it was done. When I got sober, basically they would send you to step meetings and or something like that. You know, you work the steps. You know, you don't work the steps. The steps work you. I mean, you used to hear just all kinds of stuff. And what happened was I had a few things that happened in my life, and I hit a sober bottom. This sober bottom was basically an emotional breakdown. Like 3 or 4 things happened. I'm about 1.5 years sober. And I'm just crippled. And I'm either going to kill myself, I'm going to drink, or I've got to do something. You know, I don't want to feel bad like this anymore. So what I did was I pulled out these tapes in desperation. I started listening to them, and when they gave an instruction, I would stop the tape and I would do the instruction. You know, we put the people down that we hated in black and white. You know, I'd stop the tape, put down everything. And I tried to go through in this type of a way. Not because I thought it would work, not out of any sense of virtue, just because I just didn't have another plan, and I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. Now, what happened to me was, with this experience, I started to heal spiritually. That scared kindergartner started to heal. I started to feel less and less irritable, discontented, restless. Remorseful, anxious, fearful. And I started to be more comfortable with myself and more comfortable in the environments that I was in or with people. I started to be able to share in meetings. I started to be able to do speaking commitments. I started to, you know, overcome that social phobia that I had. And I just started to heal. And, you know, I don't even know if I recognized it was the step work or what. But I just recognized that I was starting to get better. Now, I had some, at this period of time, you know, I'm sharing a lot now at meetings. And sometimes the tugboat that blows the most steam gets the tow jobs. And I had a number of guys that I was sponsoring at this point in time. I'm about a year and a half sober. And they're drinking on me. You know, you ever have a sponsee's drink on you? Make you look bad? Is Harry yours? You know, he's drinking, he's hitting on the new women, and he's borrowing money. Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll have a talk with him, you know. It was making me look bad. So the thought crosses my mind. This is about 2 or 3 years sober. The thought crosses my mind, and I know what I'll do. I'll get him over to my house, and we'll open the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll just start reading. And whenever there's an instruction, we'll both do that instruction, and I'll help him do basically what I did, and maybe I'll learn a little bit more about this in the process. And I started to bring people over to my house. And, you know, about a year or so earlier, I had met Mary Beth in a meeting. Mary Beth was just so adorable to me. The first thing she shared at this meeting was that she saw a town for sale in Pennsylvania and wanted to buy the whole town because she wanted to dress everybody up the right way. And, you know, that really made a lot of sense to me, you know. And I just thought, you know, this is great. And we went out for coffee, and I told her, you know, one of my LSD stories or something, and she just was in hysterics. And, you know, we've not been apart since then. We're living in a house now, and she's watching me bring people over to go through the bid book. And she's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I didn't really even know, but I mean, but I started to do this, and here's the one thing that I learned, because this is pretty important if you're alcoholic. The people who actually came over to my house and did the fourth and fifth step actually went out and made amends and actually started to work with other people. Every single one of them is still in AA today. This is the early 90s. Every single one of them is still in AA today. Every single one of them is working with other people, and their quality of life is out the roof. They're really living extraordinary lives. Every one of them. The people who would balk at the fourth step or not come over for the fifth step or, you know, decide that it's inconvenient to make the amends or that they don't have time to work with other people, every single one of those people are gone. They weren't able to stay in AA. You know, it's easy to come into AA. It's really hard to stay. We lose a lot of people. Think about any meeting that you go to, especially beginner meetings or something, they ask, is anybody brand new? And 2 or 3 hands go up. Well, if everybody stayed who came in, you'd increase your membership by 3 people every week. You know, but people go. For everybody that comes in, the same amount of people almost go. And what I believe is because I've been able to stay, what I believe is you have to put enough into Alcoholics Anonymous in your own recovery to get enough back from AA and recovery to be able to stay. Otherwise, what happens is you come to the conclusion that you can miss a bunch of meetings and life is becoming really important and the job is really great and the family really needs me, and you know, you disappear. And not everybody drinks that leaves AA, but a pretty large percentage do, because you know, we see them when they come back. My life has been pretty extraordinary over the years. You have to understand, I was a pathetic alcoholic. I was a bad electrician when I first got sober. You know, what a trade to have as a drunk, you know? I mean, I was blowing stuff up all the time. You know what I mean? It was absolutely crazy, some of the things that happened. I drilled down into somebody's closet by mistake and pulled one of his suits up into the attic, you know? I'd wire a kitchen addition to the wrong meter, and it would be the timer meter for the hot water heater, so the kitchen would go on at 8 o'clock at night, go off at 8 in the morning. And, you know, I mean, one time I got caught in a drill in a lingerie section of a department store. It twisted me around, caught me up in the cord and ripped my pants off, and, you know, finally unplugged from the wall, and I'm hanging on the drill like this with no pants in the lingerie section of a department store. And you got to act cool, you know, you don't want to look stupid. So, I mean, it's just constantly, you know, my boss is,
you know, don't start any fires today.
You know, it's just really, really bad. And you know, I went from being a terrible electrician to actually, and you got to understand, I never put my career as a priority. I always put my recovery as a priority. You know, I suffered a lot. The first thing I have to do in my life is maintain my participation in the recovery. We have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So I need to be about the business of maintaining my spiritual condition. But along the way, I got more efficient. I started to tell the truth more. You could count on me. I would tell you what I'm going to do and then do what I told you I was going to do, which, like, that's like a big concept. I mean, you learn that in kindergarten, but, you know, it's like a big concept for me. So I started to get better and better jobs. The last facilities maintenance job I got was I was in charge of 80 New York City schools. The entire maintenance process, you know, employees, outside contract and contract work, I have my own crews, two phones in each ear, BlackBerry going off, emergencies, you know, flying around the city, dealing with the DOE honchos. It was an insane, really, really serious job. And I was able to do it with like a relative amount of serenity. I couldn't wire, you wouldn't have put me in charge of a lemonade stand in my first 6 months. You know what I mean? You would have known that would be disaster. And so a lot of good things happened in recovery. Now, I was always the type of person who was just really bad to get in a relationship with. You know what I mean? Like if you made the mistake of like liking me, I would latch on to you, and then you know, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, over here. And it was just, you know, people would run for the hills, and well, where'd she go? You know, it was always a brutal heartache. You know, but I started to become the type of person who could actually think about other people sometimes. You know, and. You know, I've been married for 13 years now, and that is just absolutely amazing to a wonderful Irish Catholic redheaded alcoholic born on mischief night. Those are the best kind, let me tell you. It's got to be careful sometimes, but anyway, so my relation now, friends. I had Bearman and Weezer as friends, you know, when I was drinking. Okay, and these are guys who'd like steal your hubcaps, you know, and then help you look for them, you know, when you couldn't find them. These are like really, really bad, you know, losers. And today I've got friends all over the place. This year especially, I've been doing a lot of traveling, and Alcoholics Anonymous has really opened up in the last couple of years. I've got friends in a lot of different places. I've got friends in Philly. You know, I've got friends around the country, friends in other countries. And Alcoholics Anonymous has expanded into this, like, worldwide fellowship for me. And I'm really, really enjoying that. But as far as friends, I don't even look for new friends anymore. You know, they just end up coming, and the right people come into my life, and they're people who are going to bring value to my life, and not try to take things away. They're there to give, and it's just it's absolutely amazing. I took a leap of faith. It was January, you know, 13 months ago. I was really getting tired of the New York City, up at 4:30 in the morning, at my desk at 6:30, you know, back home 6 o'clock at night, you know, BlackBerry going off all night long. You know, I was just starting to question, is this where God really wants me to be, wants me to use my talents? And I had been doing a couple of things in the media. I'd been a part of a TV show and a cable satellite radio show, and some other things had like fallen in my lap, and I was just, you know, recovered enough to say okay, you know, and I had done them, and this led to an individual tracking me down and offering me basically to get involved in a startup. part of a worldwide recovery organization, and he basically said, Chris, why don't you be our media director? Why don't you, you know, start some webcasts up? You can travel around the country and interview addiction treatment leading professionals, the best of the best. You know, fly around and get interviews and go to these places and learn what they're doing. So for the last 13 months, I've been doing that. I've been hooking up with professionals. Now, until about 13 months ago, you know, I hadn't delved into the professional aspect of recovery. I did some commitments at rehabs and stuff, but I just wasn't interested in, you know, some of those things. And I was pushed into the fast lane of addiction treatment, and it's been an unbelievable year. Some things have happened that I'm unbelievably grateful for. Listen, you know, to finish up, I want to say if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, you haven't quite made that jump to, like, really participate in AA, I've got to urge you, you know, put everything you have into this process, everything you have, because the things that you'll get back will be better than anything you can imagine. Some of the forgotten promises in the book are the best years of your lives are ahead of you. That's one of the forgotten promises. That means no matter how good life has been up to now, it's going to get better. It's a pretty good promise. Frequent contact with newcomers is going to be the highlight of your life. You know, that was not the case in my first 6 months. But today it really is. It really is. Because the contact with newcomers allows me an opportunity to give of myself, and it's through giving that I get everything, you know? So if you're sitting on the fence, jump into this thing. It is, it's absolutely a remarkable experience. I wanna thank all of you for listening. I think it's probably getting close to time to eat. And, that's all I got.